Welcome, everyone, to Renegade Radio. I am your host, Andy Lowe. We are brought to you today by Renegade Concepts and the good folks here at Business Radio X. And I guess I should say welcome back to a live Thursday show. I know the last couple weeks we've been playing some pre-recorded shows, but we have guests in the studio here this week and a pretty good lineup today as we start talking about ways that people are stepping outside of conventional norms to create success in their life and in their business. It's an interesting lineup, not only in the sense that I have some guests that I think are going to bring good content, but I find it always intriguing when people have first and last names that start with the same letter. And not only do I have one of those in the studio today, I have two. So I have Harriet Hollis. She's the executive director at the Atlanta CEO Council, and Marty Mercer, who has his own sales and performance improvement business, Marty Mercer, Inc. And we're going to dig in with these guys here right now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
Harriet, let me start with you. So let's start with the Atlanta CEO Council. For those listeners that might not be familiar with the organization, tell us a little bit about who you are and what do you guys do down there?
Well, the Atlanta CEO Council is an organization of primarily technology CEOs and investors in the technology environment. This was started about 13 years ago, and it really came out of an idea from a fellow who is a serial entrepreneur here in town. His name is Raj Rajan. And he does like to say that serial entrepreneur is kind of a dirty word these days because it sort of sounds like serial murderer. But he is a lot of our constituency is serial entrepreneurs. But the goal was really to have an organization that was about developing relationships, both personally and professionally. And That's what we do. It is a networking organization. We have a few service providers that are our sponsors, and those are the law firms, the CPA firms. And we keep that into a very small group, and three-quarters of our attendees to our events that are about every 6 weeks are investors and entrepreneurs. And so what we want to do is to see those relationships develop over time. And many of our investors today were the entrepreneurs a few years ago, and they've gone through a successful exit. They want to stay in Atlanta. They want to continue to invest in Atlanta. And so the organization was really formed to support those relationships, to support that next generation of entrepreneurship, and to give back to the community. So that's what we continue to do today. As I said, we've been going for 13 years, meet about every 6 weeks down at the Buckhead Ritz, which the business folks like. And we're famous for serving lamb chops during our receptions. It is an invitation-only event. So I've had the misfortune of having to be the bouncer once or twice, but we send out invitations, register folks, and usually have 120 to 150 folks in the room on any given Monday night. So that's essentially what we do, and we have seen our organization grow over the years, and we've also seen some great spin-outs from it, such as Venture Atlanta, which I'm sure most of your listeners are probably familiar with, which is a venture capital conference. And it has grown. It is from a relatively small showcase of local companies to a group. We now have 40 companies that present, and the organization is approaching almost $1 billion in venture revenue generated through the, I think it's 8 years that it's been going on.
Well, let's break this apart just a little bit so we can understand kind of all the different components that you guys cover. So number one, let's talk about the venture capital side, and let's talk about the investor and the entrepreneur. Number one, first question out of the gate would be, what sets you guys apart? What are you guys doing a little bit differently, perhaps, or what drives your organization in that regard that maybe is different than some of the other VC angel funding type organizations that that we see in Atlanta, things like Startup Riot or Startup Lounge, et cetera?
Those are primarily focused on startups, as you can tell. And we look to companies to be involved. And of course, you know, we have investors that are involved with us, but that is not our primary goal, is to be an investor organization. Our primary goal is to help entrepreneurs who are in business get a relationship with other folks that are in business where they may be able to partner, they may have a product that would fill a gap in their product line. They are looking for opportunities to do business together. So what sets us apart is we are that C level, the executive level, and it is, you have to have a product to be invited to be a member, and you now have to have traction.
A physical product or a service?
No, not a service.
Not a service, okay.
It has to be actually a product, a software product, a hardware product. Mm-hmm. It cannot be a service. The service providers have the opportunity to be sponsors of our organization, so then they are exposed to our constituency, which might be their customer base.
So curiosity, why that decision? Why divide the service providers and the products?
Because the CEOs would not come if they knew that they were going to be sold to. So it that is it. You have to be have an actual product, and you have to have a job.
Now so, I'm going to pick at this one a little bit, because okay. This is a fun topic. It's interesting because I agree with kind of where the setup is here, but I want to dig into it a little more and expand the thought. So why is it that service people are thought of as, oh God, if those guys show up, they're going to try to sell me something. But isn't a product guy supposed to be selling something too? Why does one get along and one seems to be viewed as a little bit more, that guy might be a problem?
Well, I would have to say, yes, we're all in the business of selling something to someone else. But where we have these CEOs or CFOs who are addressing the same issues in their company. You know, how do I find the right people to come to work for me? How are you solving these issues within your product line? And so that is a difference, whereas the service providers are trying to sell their time. And I've been a service provider myself, so I know, you know, all you have to sell is your time. So they're not, that is really the difference, is you've got to have something that you're out there selling to, not the other people that are in the room. So I hope that makes a little bit of sense.
Well, it kind of does. I mean, it sounds like for one, I mean, my first thought is that, you know, if I've got a product, I don't go in thinking everybody in the room needs my product. If I'm a service provider, you ask them, who do you sell to? Oh, everybody's a good candidate.
Absolutely. Okay. That's exactly it. Thank you for articulating that for me. I appreciate it.
I've sold services too.
Right, exactly. So, but that is it. I mean, you know, a lot of our companies are in the health IT business. Mm-hmm. They're financial technology businesses. So they are looking at a broader, the much broader market. And sometimes they would be able to do business together, but they also have an opportunity to talk to each other about the fact that, you know, their challenges in their everyday business.
What are some of the successful things that you've seen develop relationship-wise where two people come together, they've been able to truly develop a relationship in a win-win fashion versus, yeah, I'm just trying to sell you something? Do you have anybody that really jumps off the page and you think, man, those guys really get it?
I'm trying to think about who that might be. I know we're focusing, because Atlanta has become sort of the center for health information technology. We've seen a lot of our groups or a lot of the companies that have gotten some early traction starting to take off. Solo Health is one of them. We've gotten some of our other investors who attend have invested in these companies. We've seen some spinoffs from, like, McKesson Healthcare. One of their executives that used to attend as part of McKesson is now attending as part of a new group. I've seen several of the senior level, particularly CFOs, who've gone through a successful exit. They've now been picked up by yet another company. So those are some of the things that we see. They develop those relationships over time. Then when a new company is started or somebody's looking for a particular talent to bring into their company, they know that they can have a conversation. They're probably going to see 15 people at an Atlanta CEO Council event and could say, you know what, I'm looking for a CEO. I'm looking for a CFO, a CIO. Who do you know? And that we've seen that happen several times.
Well, tell us about the community involvement side. You know, I mean, I kind of think of that as a little bit of an unconventional idea. Even though conventionally everybody thinks it's a good idea to be involved in community involvement, we don't see a lot of companies that actually take the initiative. It sounds good, but we don't have time to do it. So tell us about how your companies get involved and give back.
Well, a lot of our companies choose to do it on their own, but again, some of them are they're so busy getting their jobs done. I mean, the technology industry, those folks are hands-on managers every single day. The CEOs are not sitting up in an office somewhere. They're involved in the day-to-day nitty-gritty. So a few years ago was our 10th anniversary. And instead of having a ball and patting ourselves on the back, we decided that we would do something where we could invest in a worthwhile cause that matched our mission, which is about growing entrepreneurs and supporting that next generation. So we looked around and we found the Ron Clark Academy down in South Atlanta, and I know a lot of people are familiar with it. A lot of people are not. I was surprised. I had seen the movie with Matthew Perry, and I was familiar with it as being a mom and having kids that gone through school. A lot of the folks in our organization knew nothing about it. And so for 3 years, we put on a fundraiser. Well, the relationships that have developed between many of our executives and the Ron Clark Academy have been terrific. Our executives jumped in with their business experience and sat on advisory boards and worked with them. We also raised something over $80,000 to donate to the school. So, you know, a school like that, I mean, all schools are always looking for funding. So we worked with them for 3 years, and we felt like we had pretty much put in as much time as we could. We'd made an impact. This year we are working with the Junior Achievement of Atlanta. They are in the process of getting ready to build a center at the Georgia World Congress Center. It's called J.A. BizTown and J.A. Finance Park. Again, it dovetails so nicely with our mission, which is about financial literacy, entrepreneurship, and being ready to go to work when you get out of school.
That is such a needed thing. Our kids just do not have financial literacy. They do not have the entrepreneur education. I mean, we really need that in our community.
So we are going. We're going at it a two-pronged way. We're going to have an event in December that will raise funds for the capital campaign, and then we are also going to spend a day at the school at a school. We'll choose which school, doing a junior achievement program that they already have the curriculum for, called Be an Entrepreneur. So we hope to take 50 to 60 executives into a high school and spend a day. And then my hope is that many of our organizations will then choose to adopt it on their own and take their group in there to spend a day or donate through Junior Achievement. So we'll get started on that, and then we're actually, one of our members is hosting the event at their home in December, and then next year we'll have the event at the new facility at the Junior Achievement at the World Congress Center.
So 13 years in, obviously a lot has probably gone on and a lot has changed. What's the future look like for the Atlanta CEO Council?
Well, we are continuing to develop our relationships with other organizations to make sure that they realize we can provide them with, you know, a certain exclusive opportunity. I mean, we're a sales opportunity for folks like the Metro Atlanta Chamber or the Gwinnett County Chamber, and that they can say, I can recommend you as a member to the Atlanta CEO Council. This is an opportunity for you to spend time with your peers who are also executives. So we continue to develop those relationships. We are working on peer-to-peer smaller groups. We've been working on that for about the last year and a half, and what we've come up with is all of our members love to hear inspirational, thought-provoking, way-out-of-the-box ideas, sort of like a mini TED Talk. So we've started putting those on prior to our regular event. Trying to get business people to fold one more event into their life is almost impossible. So we're having some of those pre-events, and those have been fascinating and extremely well-received. Our last, in July, we had a professor from Georgia Tech come and talk about biomimicry, which everybody said, well, what in the heck is that? Well, that's those things like what's in nature that works and how can you apply it in business, such as the I know one of the way a grasshopper's leg works. It helps with articulating mechanical arms. So, you know, instead of trying to improve on nature, what works, let's figure it out and adapt it to, you know, either a product or a system. So those have been some of the interesting things. We had the woman who's this would be a great guest. She runs the Brain Lab at Kennesaw State. And they are actually able to control a computer by just wearing something on your head. And that is primarily, you know, they're doing research with people who are in that locked-in state. Well, that was a huge hit. People absolutely found that fascinating. And, of course, it has commercial applications. So it's not just something interesting it's that gets them thinking. It is also, this would have an application in business. So that those are some of the directions that we're going in the future. We continue to want to reach out, continue to develop the relationships within our community.
Well, for people listening that think, you know, they'd like to look up some more information, or maybe they feel like they might be a good fit for the council and they'd like to look into how they would pursue being invited to a meeting, how would they go about finding out information or getting in touch with you?
Just go on our website, atlantaceo.org, and there's a tab right there that says, I'd like to join. Just fill it out, and it will come directly to me, and I'll be in touch with you. So it's got the simple, here's how you qualify to be a member, and if you qualify, or just send it in, and that's it. But that's the easiest thing to do is to just to go to atlantaceo.org, and we'll find you.
Well, Harriet, I've got some more questions here for you before we wrap up today, but in the meantime, I'd like to bring Marty into the conversation. Can you hang out with us for a few minutes while we chat?
Sure.
All right. Thanks so much. So, Marty, let's talk about you.
Okay.
I mean, I think you've got a pretty unconventional story, so so I'm just going to let you take it to the top. I know some people may have read some of this off of your bio information, but tell us how Marty Mercer today came to be from the Marty Mercer of yesteryear.
Well, I spent about 25 or so years selling and managing sales teams. That wasn't my original intent. All the way through junior high and high school and college, I was going to go to medical school.
Really? Okay.
And my mom's a nurse and is now still a practicing nurse practitioner. Sees patients 3 days a week at the age of 75 plus. Yeah, she's a trooper. And I got to college and decided, you know what? I don't want to go to medical school, but I want to stay in healthcare. So I ended up one day in consulting and was working with a software company, and they sent me the original Motorola Gordon Gekko brick phone, the one that Gordon Gekko talked on the beach to Bud. Remember that scene?
Right, right. The one he got back in the second movie?
Yeah, yeah. And so I called the company that I was working with, and I said, why do you send me this phone? And they said, well, we always send that phone to people who sell $1 million of software. And that was the first realization that I was a sales guy. I thought I was a consultant who was just dabbling in software. So I got out of that, went into sales, and ended up spending about 25 years managing sales teams. And as you noted on my webpage, one day you realize that all you do is fly around and eat too much and drink too much and don't exercise and sell and go, go, go. And I went to the men's clothing store, and the guy said, no, you're not a 48, you're a 50. You know, we have a great line of the Orson Welles collection over here. That was quite shocking. So I transformed myself physically, and at the same time, approximately, got transformed from a business perspective because, you know, surviving multiple acquisitions, finally the last one caught me. So I thankfully was riffed out in 2007. And for the first time ever, I actually followed the advice of someone, and they said, go to this outsourcing company and walk through this to figure out what do you want to do next in your career. And I followed the directions and realized that what I should have been doing was doing what I'm doing today. And so that's really getting on the other side of the table with sales teams and helping sales teams figure out better ways to develop sales strategies, better sales process, sales tactics, better presentation style. There's a lot of hardworking, smart salespeople out there, but they throw out a lot of crap to customers, and they wonder why it doesn't work. And so for the last 5 years, I worked for myself, focusing on mostly IT organizations, but not all IT organizations, helping them develop better sales strategies. These would be companies that are selling, you know, $1 million applications that take 2 years to sell. And as Harriet and I were talking before the interview here, it's a tough thing to spend 2 years trying to sell something to somebody and get second place, because there's no money in sales for second place. So that's what I do today.
Well, let's chat a little bit about sales, and I want to come back to your personal story before we're done here today. But so talking about sales, I mean, you know, for the last 5 years, we've seen a lot of changes in the marketplace, and especially in sales. So what are some things most notable that come to mind for you that you've seen change in the last half decade?
Significant, and I just, you know, for me, it was, you know, I went on my own in 2007, 2008. Everybody remember what happened in 2008? So I've kind of, you know, tried to fight through the down economy curve. But what was interesting in that is that a lot of my customers refer to selling today as selling in the new reality. And so it is a new reality for them. And so some of the symptoms of that are things like extended sales cycles. So when they said it used to take us 6 months or 9 months to sell something, it's 18 months, 24 months, maybe even 36 months. The biggest thing that I see that it's a significant problem, that's why it's interesting to have Harriet here today, is that the approval level of people who used to could sign off on a $100,000, $500,000 deal, now they get to sign off on $10,000. And it's basically gone right to the boardroom and the executive suite. And so almost everything over $100,000, I'm using that in a loose term, has to have high-level executive approval and sign-off. And so that requires salespeople to have a better affinity and understanding of what's going on in the boardroom, what's going on in the executive suite. And the fact of the matter is they don't. They know the people that use their products. They know that operational level. They know the end users well. But they struggle with articulating and having a good conversation with executives. And so I spend a lot of time helping them figure out what should they say, how should they say it, when should they say it. And so that bump up to the boardroom and the executive suite of approvals is probably one of the biggest things that I see across all of our customers, not just IT, you know, hardware, equipment, capital equipment. It's had a big impact.
Well, that's a definite shift, and it's an interesting one in the IT field because many executives do not speak IT.
Right.
It's a completely different language, and some of the sales guys have gotten used to over the years speaking in IT. So how do you manage the bilingual? How do you go in and talk to the executive when you've been, you know, versed in IT speak for the last several years?
A lot of the people I do work with are IT software hardware kind of folks, and so their first call was the CIO. Well, now the CIO may not have the budget, and so now they're saying the line of business execs have it. It's the CFO, COO, VP of sales, VP of HR, etc. So what I now tell the sales organizations, and it kind of ruffles the edges a little bit of the product people, of the marketing people, is I tell them this: stop studying your product. Whatever today you know about your product, and I don't care if you've even only been here a month, you know enough. Start studying the customer. What I see almost hands down across the board is they don't know enough about the customer. And that's at multiple levels. They don't know the strategy. They don't know the vision, the mission. They don't know the individuals. They don't have a way of figuring out a relationship with those folks. And so they come in, do a little product puke, think it looks good, and they kind of get slapped upside the head. And they basically find out that their products are about the same as their competitors. Their price points are probably about the same. And the fact that they ask a couple of dumb questions at the beginning of the meeting, those executives that we just heard don't have a lot of time, you get kicked out the door. So I tell them, spend the majority of your time in preparing for a sales call, studying the customer and those individuals, and don't spend as much time on the product, because you're going to lose because you don't know what's going on the customer side.
Well, that's such an interesting point. We have a show that we do called Atlanta Sales Talk Radio, and we've had several executives come on in the recent past who have said a very similar thing. They speak of a salesperson coming into the organization, sitting down, and the first question or, you know, out of the gate is, tell us a little bit about your company.
Yeah. You know?
And they pretty much said, we ended the meeting right on the spot.
Well, they've spent millions of dollars on their webpage, right? They've got a high-paid chief marketing officer who does all kinds of things on their webpage. They got all kinds of heavy assets on their webpage. And that, so what the salesperson basically says is, I really don't want to work that hard. I'd like you to do the heavy lift. You know, the other question is, what keeps you up at night? You know, that they just want to puke at that. You're supposed to know that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the other challenge is the reverse of that, right? The customer is putting all their information out, but so is the selling organization. So there's every white paper, PDF, PowerPoint, online demo available on the sales team's webpage. The customer's already read it. The customer's already vetted it. The customer's already gone to the trade show and gotten an hour-long demo in the booth, right? they already know everything. You show up and start talking about the basics, and they're like, no. So again, that the conversation ends kind of quickly, and they're befuddled. And so what happens is they do that once or twice, and they say, boy, calling on executives is a bad idea. I should stop doing it. And it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy of, you know, and they stop doing it. And then luckily for me, somebody in the sales organization says, we've got to get to the top level guys, and they recognize that they're not, and they call me, and I go to work helping them.
Yeah, well, now here's part number two of that. So just ironic that you're talking about getting to the executive, because we've also had executives come in that say, I've got all these salespeople clamoring to get in my door, but if they really understood my organization, they would realize I'm not the person they need to be talking to.
Yeah.
So again, research-wise, I mean, what should salespeople be doing to really understand who they should be moving in to talk to when they go into a business?
Well, as much as I now live in social media, and I don't know about you two, how much you live in it, my guess is you two both live in social media pretty heavily, and we hear about it all the time, right? Remarkably, what I see for the last 2 years is still a hesitancy or reticence or something, whatever the right word is, from salespeople to dig into social media. I don't mean tweeting. I'm not talking about being Kim Kardashian or, you know, whoever. I mean digging into LinkedIn. I mean digging into Plaxo. I mean digging into that customer's webpage. I mean actually reading their annual report. I mean, if it's a publicly traded company, they're required by law in the 10-Ks and 10-Qs to tell the public what they see as their problems. It's right there. Now, it's in tiny little print, so I tell the guys in my class, it's in tiny print. For some reason, they always print it on that little flimsy paper, but now it's all on PDFs on the webpage, right? So I'll ask questions. Who all's on LinkedIn? Not everybody raises their hand. I'll say, who's really using LinkedIn? Even more hands go down. And I tell them this. I don't call anybody that I don't know until I go look them up on LinkedIn. I look both of you up on LinkedIn. I know she went to the University of Georgia in journalism. You did the Iron Man. I read that somewhere. Isn't that what you were? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Used to be in TV, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's not my second habit, but it's not the second habit of most of the people that I'm dealing with. So there's a wealth of information out there. Twitter's another one. I tell them, look, get on Twitter. I don't care if you ever tweet. That's not why I want you on Twitter. Your customers are tweeting, and they're telling you what's important to them, and you're ignoring it because you're not on Twitter. So I don't know. I over time, I think that will change. I have some new peers that are actually the ages of my children, so I'm going to put them in the millennials. But I think of them as my peers. Their grasp and willingness to go to social media is quite different than the baby boomers, let's say. Now, there's still some bad habits that I want them to fix. But so this may change over time, I think. But right now, the baby boomers, it's like a new awakening when I talk to them about Twitter and LinkedIn. And I see you shaking your head.
I just agree with you so much, because I know that hardly any of our members will set up an appointment unless they have gone and looked at somebody's LinkedIn profile and they want to know who else you're connected to. And you know, I'm connected because of my position to a lot of heavy hitters. Right. So I don't connect to a lot of people. I am pretty particular about it. But trying to explain to kids coming out of college, you need a great LinkedIn profile. Yeah. They don't really understand it. What you hear is, gee, it's kind of awkward. It's a pain to use, blah, blah. I just don't really get it. I'm like, if you are in the real world, you need to be on LinkedIn.
But they're banging on Facebook eight times
Facebook,
a day.
Man, forget it. Forget it. But and also the Twitter. I have a Twitter stream through the Atlanta CEO Council. I do not have one on my personally. But I also follow my sponsors and a lot of my members because I want to know what they're doing. So, I mean, to me, it seems, and I'm a baby boomer, it seems common sense, but you do have kind of a gap between the older group, and then the younger group who says, it's not friendly enough. It's not what I'm accustomed to dealing with. And I want to tweet about who won the game last night. But all of our clients are putting information out about their customers, you know, their points of pain.
Right. Yeah.
Well, that's a great point, though. I mean, I think a lot of people, and this can seep into the older crowd, too, but it's I want to be followed, not to follow. You know, I want people listening to what I have to say, and I think Facebook gets a lot of traffic because it's easy to blast your opinion out there, and people aren't as interested in what someone else has to say.
Well, see, and I actually, I do tweet some stuff that I like to think is relevant and important, mostly on sales stuff. Every now and then it'll be something goofy and funny. The other day, I saw this hilarious quote from Leave It to Beaver, and I just thought it was funny, and I used to watch that show, and so I tweeted it, and a guy replied back. So that was a fun little exchange. What I do now, that this is what I think is just so dramatic. I mean, having started in sales way back in the mid-'80s, when the internet wasn't here and there was no email, you had to read brochures, you had the yellow pages, all those kinds of things. This is pre-fax machines, by the way, as well. You guys remember that.
Mm-hmm.
What I do now is I follow people that I think are smart in the space that I want, that I'm in. So I follow people in sales, I follow people in health IT, and I follow the healthcare providers because my customers are selling to providers, the hospitals and physicians. And so I follow 6, 8, 10 people. They're tweeting all the time. I have people ask me, how did you know that? How did you find that out? How were you like one of the first people to tell me about that topic? And I just laugh and I go, I didn't do anything except read my Twitter feed. It's that simple. Smart people send out tweets. They have links to their blogs. They have links to news stories. That's how I stay on top of almost everything, is via Twitter, by following smart people. It's free research.
Well, this sounds like a great spot where I'm going to want to bring Harriet back in. Before I do, if someone out there listening says, hey, I think I need help with my sales team, or I'm on a sales team and I'm having trouble getting to the right people, or I was the guy that walked in the last meeting and said, tell me about your company, how do they reach out to you, Marty?
Very easy. My name, Marty Mercer, martymercer.com. LinkedIn is Marty Mercer, and Twitter is, strangely enough, Marty Mercer.
All right. Well, the last thing you were saying there, it really sounded to me like the important thing of social media and, you know, as I was saying, a lot of things are outbound facing, but what it's really about is relationship. And Harriet, you have come right out from the gate and said, it's all about relationship.
Absolutely. And I do tweet some things. Primarily, I retweet, you know, what are my CEOs interested in? They're interested in deals, who's gotten money, who's been funded, and they're, you know, and then there are some topics through, you know, things like the Harvard Business Review and those sorts of things that are specific. But that's about it. I mean, I keep a very narrow focus, and I think that that's important in what you're doing. But it also gives me an opportunity to see what my members are doing when they're having events, when they've got something great going on. So, you know, I think the Twitter stream, both you don't have to be actively involved, but it is great free research, and it will give you a lot of information. We do have a active LinkedIn group. It's restricted to our members. And so, again, that's another benefit that they get because they know anybody else has been through a vetting process to get into our LinkedIn group. So you end up seeing relationships. I had a member say, I'm looking for a great, I've got to redo all of my IT. I'm looking for a great service provider who's worked with somebody that they feel strongly about. Well, several people responded. And all of that was within our own group. But, you know, that's a great way for people to provide services and to help each other. So, again, these were people who probably had not even met at one of our events, and they connected because somebody said, oh, I worked with so-and-so, and they were great.
Well,
call me.
There's a trust level there that's been created. And so now you're sort of borrowing trust and trading trust and networking on trust, which I think is pretty powerful.
That's right. And I will get applications from people, and they'll – I'll look them up. That's the first thing I do is I go look them up on LinkedIn and see who in our organization they're connected to. And then I contact those people. If I've looked up their company and I've tried to find out information about them, but if I feel like they're kind of on the bubble and I need some validation, I'll see who they're connected to on LinkedIn. And if I get something, a response that says, maybe I met this person, I have no knowledge, that kind of, you know, that doesn't help their case much. So be careful about who you do connect with, because I think it's important. You need to have an actual, some sort of a relationship with that person. So, but it is validation, and it does help develop that trust relationship.
Do you put any weight or value on how many connections they've got on LinkedIn? Does that tell you anything?
Not to me, because I will tell you that the chairman of our organization, Sig Mosley, who is one of the best-known business people and has done so well in the Atlanta community, runs MLA Ventures, he will connect to anybody because he's that kind of a person. He is very generous with his time, and he wants to see everybody succeed, and he is so willing. So he'll connect to just about anybody. But
well, I do too.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
it doesn't mean that much to me.
I was saying, like, if you're evaluating somebody who wants to join and mm-hmm. they've only got 89 connections, does that say anything?
It depends on who it is.
Okay.
It's the who, not the it's the quality, not the quantity.
Okay. Yeah, it almost says the opposite thing that it used to. It used to say, oh, this person's not really a connector. They're not really connected. But I don't know. I'd take somebody that had 89 mm-hmm. solid yeah. relationships. They know the people, and those 89 people will pick up the phone if they make the call, versus I got 600 and nobody knows me.
That's absolutely it. And that's really how I, you know, vet the process or put them through that. So, yeah, it's about quality. And it's just like with our organization. We don't want to have the largest organization right. in town. We don't want to have everybody. We want to make sure it's the right people who are decision makers and deal makers. Those are the people that we want in our room.
That's a good question coming back to the sales side of things. Is that a tactic that you're seeing employed more often these days, where it's quantity or quality over quantity? I mean, there used to be the scattergun approach yeah. to sales, but not anymore.
Another thing that, you know, the first controversial thing I try to say in my classes is, you know, stop studying your products. Start studying your customers. The second thing I really just pound on them is you've got too many prospects in your funnel. Your funnel, your pipeline is too big. You're chasing stuff that's not there. You need to spend more time with fewer prospects. But that scares almost everybody, including smart VPs, because they think, or they've grown up with saying, well, the size of my funnel is a way of, I don't want to get into that conversation, but you know that size was important. And they're wasting time. And so my fear as a VP and my fear is now as an outsider coming in is that they're not working on deals that are good deals for them. They're chasing bad deals. And meanwhile, their competition is beating them in the places where they could be winning. And so I am all for tightening up your pipeline, your funnel, chasing fewer deals, spending more time with those customers. But it takes a little guts for some of these people. Because some of the executives in some of these companies are evaluating the VP of sales based on the size of their pipeline.
Well, here's a question. I want to get your thoughts on this. And Harriet, maybe you've seen some of this with some of the entrepreneurs in your organization. But we'll go renegade thought here for a minute. The conventional wisdom is work really hard. Put in lots of time. Put in lots of hours. You know, the busier you are, the better your result ultimately will be. And I'm kind of complete opposite. In fact, in training for the Ironman, I adopted a plan that was much more focused on the quality of the workout than the quantity of the workout. I trained less than probably a lot of people did, but I got more out.
Yeah.
And I'm always a proponent of that for business people. Look, if you can have a concentrated effort and work 3 hours a day, I don't need you to just put hours on the clock.
Yeah.
Are you seeing that as a second valuable piece that salespeople and business people need to adopt?
Well, I agree with you. Now, do I see it? No. Now, me personally, I'll check my email and my phone on the weekends. It is rare that I'm sitting at my desk, and I work out of my house, that I'm sitting at my desk for prolonged amount of time in serious work mm-hmm. on Saturday or Sunday. I just don't think it gets me anywhere. I need downtime. I need relaxation time. So that's similar to that idea. However, my customers, that's not what they're doing. I won't name names, but some of the largest software providers in the world, their reps are working 60 and 70 hours a week. They are basically on call 24/7. They may go on vacation, but they're really not mentally on vacation. They're working. And that's being driven from the top down. That's this new economy we're dealing in. That's the consolidation that's gone on. That's all the M&A that's gone on. That's all of the reduction of force that's gone on. And so now everybody has five jobs. And so I see a ton of just go, 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 go. And if I look busy, that's going to be good for me. Now, the results aren't always borne out, right?
Right.
So that's why, to be honest with you, my friends say, hey, you going to come back in? You going to come back in the corporate world? And I say, that is never my intention ever again. I like where I am. I can pick my hours because I see these guys working like dogs. Do they make more money? Yeah, but I wonder what the real balance is on that.
Yeah, so here at Top Down, I mean, he says it's coming from the top down. What's the buzz? What's the conversation like? What are you hearing from the CEOs in your world about dealing with that type of issue in the workplace?
Well, I think that they are anxious to make sure that they are, you know, taking advantage of every opportunity and that they are inspiring their workforce. Again, that's one reason that we sort of evolved in our talks. We don't bring in these iconic CEOs to just talk about, well, how did I get to where I am and how did I make this successful company? They told me, I want to hear more things that are inspirational. How can I be a better person, not just a better CEO?
We mentioned that kind of at the beginning, talking about the difference between teaching management and teaching leadership.
Right.
I mean,
right.
We're seeing that evolve, yes?
Yes, yes. We are definitely seeing it evolve, and people are taking, you know, much more time to look at how do all of the pieces fit together. One thing, and Marty and I talked a little bit about this, was just, you know, the biggest frustration that I hear is just being able to find people to bring them into an organization. There's a big gap between those that are ready to go to work and have, you know, the skills that you're looking for, or they're teachable, so that you can teach them the skills.
You lit up on that one, right, Marty? Yeah. I mean, that's the real issue, yeah?
There are guys that have had great successes and great careers, and then I get in the room with them, and I spend two days with them. I'm spending 16 hours or more, mm-hmm. sometimes 3 days. So I kind of get a feel for who these people are. And some of them are not teachable. They want to keep doing it the same old way. They admit they're not getting the results they want. And yet when you say, well, then let's change the way we want to go about it, just change one tiny thing, they don't want to.
Yeah, a lot of companies are moving away from this. It's like the old boiler room scene when he goes, who has a Series 7? And the one guy raises his hand. He's like, get out. Yeah. We don't hire brokers here.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, you know, because you already know they're not trainable. Right. And culture is becoming such a buzzword. People are more concerned about cultural fit than skill set.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've had some of the CEOs talk to me, and they say, well, we're looking for people. I can train them to do whatever we need them to do. But I need somebody who can actually go out and have a conversation with another person. And they're going to be comfortable. They know how to dress. They know how to shake hands. They know how to take somebody to lunch. They know how to travel. But they just can actually have a conversation with another person. And that is something that is not taught. A lot of parents don't teach it, but it certainly is not taught in the schools. And, of course, a lot of these kids graduate from college, and I'm sort of close to this because I have one that's just a couple of years out of school and one that's going to graduate in about a year. And, you know, it's the disconnect between the universities and how these kids actually transition into the workplace is tremendous. And that's something that our CEOs are very concerned about. We had a meeting just last week, and this took up the majority of our discussion. Again, that's one reason we decided we wanted to connect with Junior Achievement, because they're teaching these kids, here's all of these opportunities out here. How do you get from, you know, what is the path that you need to follow to get to those opportunities? And it's not just go to med school, go to law school, go to grad school, become a consultant. There's a whole lot more opportunities out there, and nobody teaches, here's how you go be a software salesperson. You know, but you might have the personality to do it, but you know, they just don't teach them how to do that. So
let me reach out on one last topic here before we wrap up today, because it ties in, I think, well to Marty, the journey that you took in a physical sense, and I know I've been through it, and I think we're seeing this show up in the business world, and it's this idea that the solutions to get to success in fitness or in business or in relationships or anything else, they're really not that complicated, but they do require a level of consistency and discipline. I mean, you know, the secret to being in great shape is eat right and work out. Yeah. I mean, it's not complex, but yet everybody's looking for the magic pill. They're looking for the shortcut. Nobody wants to just get up and go, you know, run a mile every day and slowly build their way to that success. I mean, what do you guys see out there with that regard, and what are maybe some things that you're doing or teaching to people within your sphere of influence to move to that model of behavior, which I think ultimately is going to make us more successful?
Well, I've been doing the sales. I still don't think of myself as a sales trainer. I still think of myself as a sales VP who happens to be on the teaching side, right? So I have been doing that now 5 years. At first, I was sort of teaching from the book, as you could imagine, right? But now, as I've gotten more comfortable and the book is in my head, I now recognize that I need to simplify the message in the room, and I need to get them to understand that it isn't that complicated. Number one, that there isn't a magic pill, as you just said. And number two, if you were to do two or three things differently than you're doing today, that's probably good enough. Because those two or three things are probably what's holding you back. And that's true in your personal life, spiritual life, business life, whatever. So I try to point out, look, I'm going to give you 100 things. You pick the two or three. So I challenge at the end of every one of my classes, pick your two or three that you're going to commit to and send it to me in an email. And I try to really make them do that. And not all of them do. About a third do. And I bet you that those third are the people who end up being successful. So my goal is to simplify things because it's a weird, crazy, complicated world out there, and you think you got to do everything, and I don't think you do.
And that's part of what our folks try to come together, and certainly as we have some of the folks that are now investors who have been the serial entrepreneurs, they've had a successful exit, now they're either angel investors or part of a fund, they try to tell them, you can't do it all, but do pick the things that you know that you're good at. Find the other people to fill in those gaps. You know, it's the rare bird that you would find who is a great leader and also takes care of all the administrative pieces as well. So, you know, make sure that you put a team together who is going to, that will create that great leadership for your company and set a great example. But I do know that some of our younger ones, they're moving fast because they want to make sure that they can take advantage of the opportunity while it's out there. So, I mean, a lot of them, it's tough. A lot of them aren't as involved. They've got marriages, they've got kids, they've got a company, you know, moving fast. So, you know, we've had several of them who have said, I just can't serve on the board. I just don't have enough time. Would love to. Well, I'm at your events every time I'm in town, but the work-life balance is always tricky. But I do see that there's a look at it. People do take it into account. They want people to be happy personally so that they are a better employee. And, you know, the basics of how you get things done, I don't think have changed that much, but you've got to continue to focus on just take care of the few basics that make your company successful. You know, make sure you follow up, make sure you develop a relationship. Those are the things that will help you move forward.
I think those are great points, and I think there is, you know, the ability to manage work-life balance. I mean, you know, I have a personal journey that exemplifies that. Marty, I know you do as well, and Harriet, I'm sure you see it every day with the people that you work with. Not everybody's stressed to the hilt and unhappy. So, guys, I appreciate you being on the show today. I think you've shared some fantastic insight with our listeners today. One more time, so if they're looking to get information from you guys or get in touch, Harriet, how would they reach out and find out about Atlanta CEO Council?
Just visit AtlantaCEO.org, and I will get an email from you.
And Marty, again, if I've made a horrible sales presentation and it's time to make some change, how do I get in touch with you?
Just check out MartyMercer.com.
All right, guys, again, thank you so much for being here. Thank you, everyone, for listening and tuning in. We hope you'll listen in every Thursday as we continue to visit with professionals who are creating change and success in their life by getting outside of traditional norms. I'm Andy Lowe, your host, and until next time, remember, opportunity lies in the impossible, but you have to be willing to break the rules of conventional thinking.